71 years after Adolf Hitler died, his name is still universally known, as are the gruesome feats of the Third Reich he led. Hitler wanted to create a master race, but he was by no means the first person to think of such a thing or act upon it. Our country was one of many where people embraced the concept of eugenics, breeding out some traits to arrive at a healthier, happier population. Breeding out is the euphemistic way to put it. Forced sterilization is the plain term, and we had it. And Adam Cohen writes of this period in his book, Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Adam Cohen is a Harvard Law graduate who worked both as a senior writer for Time magazine and as a member of the New York Times editorial board. Adam has written other books, most recently a book about the staying power of the first 100 days of the FDR presidency called Nothing to Fear. Adam Cohen, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good to be here.
It's hard to believe that the breezy, let's fix this attitude of FDR was less than 20 years after some of the events in this book.
Yeah, that is quite a combination there, isn't it?
It truly is. Now, the term is not one you hear every day anymore, and by that I mean the title of the book. What did imbecile mean in officialdom?
Well, you know, they actually had official categories of mental defect, as they said at the time. At the bottom were idiots, and in the middle were imbeciles, and at the top, but still defective, were morons. And one little pedantic point, but although the Supreme Court had that famous phrase in this case, three generations of imbeciles are enough, the characters we're talking about, Carrie Buck and her mother and daughter, were not imbeciles, and in fact, Carrie and her mother had been labeled morons, which is one step up. So the Supreme Court, in addition to everything else horrible they did, actually demoted Carrie by one category.
So, I mean, were there actual scientific reasons for the different labels, moron, imbecile, idiot?
Yeah, it was based on IQ score. So there were IQ score cutoffs, and it capped off at, you know, an IQ of 75 for the top range of morons, yeah.
All right, we can talk about the test they used later, which itself was suspect. I did a double take when you listed Virginia's figures on sterilizing quote-unquote unfit people. The first date was 1927. As I looked at it quickly, I thought the second date was 1929, but it was 1979. This went on for more than 50 years in Virginia. How did it go on for so long?
Well, you know, eugenics was very popular, and it became a little less popular with the rise of Nazi Germany, so that was one setback, and then it became less popular again in the 60s with the rise of the rights revolution and our recognition of the rights of marginalized groups, including the developmentally disabled and institutionalized people. But even with all those setbacks, there was always still some sentiment for it. So, yes, it's shocking how long it persisted in being carried out.
And in fact, you point out that it went on into the early 80s in Oregon, and in California went on into the 21st century. Is that right?
Yeah. In California, the 21st century examples were not under an official eugenic sterilization law, but it was found that it was going on in the prison system. Oregon was actually the last state to dismantle its eugenic sterilization office in 1983. It's amazing how long it lasted officially, and there still is underground, you know, examples of eugenic sterilization going on, like that prison example in California.
So I have to think that by the time 1983 rolled around, Oregon had at least changed the name of the office to something that didn't use the term eugenics. It was pretty well in bad faith by then, wasn't it?
That's true. They did rename it, but it was the same office, you know, continuously operating. Yeah, it's just shocking how long it persisted in other states as well. It feels like a very old concept, this idea that we're going to uplift the human race genetically.
Did the Buck versus Bell case really open the gates for all this sterilizing? It sounds like it had been going on for a while before that case in 1927.
That's correct. We passed our first eugenic sterilization law in Indiana in 1907, and there was a fair amount of sterilization going on before 1927. In Virginia, where all this took place, didn't pass its law until 1924, which was a little late. But Virginia didn't want to start sterilizing people until it could test its law constitutionally in the courts. So they created a test case, which Carrie Buck was at the center of, and they had that go through the Virginia courts up to the Supreme Court, and that's why all this came to a sort of legal head in 1927. And after the opinion, there was more eugenic sterilization. Mississippi passed a law the next year, and the rate of sterilization sort of picked up nationally. But yeah, the Supreme Court opinion really comes sort of in the middle of the eugenic sterilization era.
Haven't asked at this point whether it was usually women like Carrie Buck, or was it often men too, or was there a pretty even split?
Yeah, it was often men. It was actually after Buck versus Bell was decided, the gender mix changed a bit. It was more women afterwards, but both men and women were being sterilized, and you saw this a lot of men in prison hospitals where they would give vasectomies to the men who they thought shouldn't reproduce, and women were often, like Carrie, sent to these colonies where they were taken away for being epileptic or feeble-minded, and then often sterilized there.
So when we talk about epilepsy and the so-called feeble-mindedness, I mean, it sounds like there was a really broad range of categories for which people would have been deemed unfit to reproduce.
Absolutely right. And it varied by state, but different states had different categories in their statutes. And in some cases, feeble-minded was a big one. And this was this very loose category of people who they thought were just not, you know, intellectually fit. But there were all these other people who also, depending on the state they lived in, might be sterilized. And that included the deaf, that included the blind, that included, in some cases, the poor, the indolent or lazy. So it was really whatever the legislature wanted to put in. And it ended up being a grab bag of categories that state legislature thought, you know, we wanted to breed out of the race.
And were they sufficiently broad that a case could be easily made that somebody fit into one of them?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Carrie Buck was brought before a commission of feeble-mindedness when her foster family wanted to send her away. And this commission ruled that she was epileptic and feeble-minded. She wasn't epileptic. She'd never had a seizure and never did in her entire life. She wasn't feeble-minded. She had done well in school. So it was very easy to get these commissions, whoever was doing the deciding, to declare someone to be feeble-minded, often on very scant evidence. And that's true of some of the other categories as well.
All right, we'll talk more with Adam Cohen about imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American eugenics, and the sterilization of Carrie Buck. You'll learn more about Carrie and her court case when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Adam Cohen, Harvard Law graduate and journalist, too. He has written a book about the age of eugenics in America and when it reached its greatest legal limit, which was involving the sterilization of people who were deemed unfit to reproduce. His book is called Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. You'll learn more about Carrie Buck from Virginia in a few moments. And you can join our discussion on the exchange. Your questions and comments about eugenics and sterilization, welcome here at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Adam, as we get in and we read the details about who voted for for sterilization of Carrie Buck, it was an 8-1 Supreme Court decision. And as we can only groan that Earl Warren, for example, was for the internment of Japanese in California, some great minds on this court went ahead and were part of the eight that voted for sterilizing Carrie Buck.
That's correct. The Chief Justice was William Howard Taft, who was a former president of the United States before he was on the Supreme Court, and also had been a Yale law professor. Louis Brandeis, who was the great progressive hero. He had been the trust buster of choice during the President Wilson administration. And then, of course, the great Oliver Wendell Holmes, who many people still consider to be the greatest Supreme Court justice in history. This is a man who had been a professor at Harvard Law School, had written, you know, some seminal works of legal scholarship, and he was the one who wrote this terrible decision and was the most pro-eugenic member of the Supreme Court.
And what was his quote? Something like, three generations of imbeciles is enough?
Yeah, that's the classic quote, which was wrong in every way. There were not three generations of imbeciles. There was nothing wrong with Carrie Buck. There was probably nothing wrong with her mother. There was certainly nothing wrong with the baby that they tested as an infant and decided that the baby was also mentally troubled in some way. So there weren't three generations. Feeble-mindedness, whatever it was, imbecility was not inherited in that way, so cutting it off would not solve the problem. And And then just the fact that, you know, Carrie Buck and her mother were really morons under the classification system, not imbeciles. And then there was so much other bad stuff in the decision. It not only upheld the sterilization and the law, but it really, in very dramatic eugenic language, said, you know, we must sterilize more people who sap the strength of the state. So it was really just a terrible ruling in every particular way.
Let's backtrack a bit. When did the eugenics movement rise and where?
Yeah, so, you know, it began in England with this half-cousin of Charles Darwin, Francis Galton, who coined the term eugenics, and it comes over to America, and it's adopted really by the more educated and progressive people who are sort of following these things. It gets a following among doctors, among scientists, at universities, and very often within any particular state, it would be the universities and the smart folks who were the first to adopt it. So, like within Virginia, where Carrie Buck was sterilized, the University of Virginia, the big educational institution in the state, was the hotbed of eugenic thought. And Harvard University nationally was one of the main centers of eugenics. The president and the president emeritus, President Lowell and President Emeritus Eliot, were both very active in eugenics and supporting eugenics. And the genetics department there had some leading geneticists who were writing textbooks and advocating for eugenics. So it really started in the, you know, most educated, the professions, the elites, but it swept the country. And you had ministers competing in eugenic sermon contests to see who could deliver the best sermon about, you know, why religion should support eugenics. You had women's clubs around the country holding, you know, meetings that talked about eugenic marriage. So it really was a widespread movement, but particularly in the upper elite classes and in the middle class.
Well, it sounds like more people like us. We want more people like us.
Exactly. And it's interesting, it happened in the 20s, a time that, you know, is presented very often to us as being, you know, a carefree time, the roaring 20s, and flappers and parties, but it was actually a time of considerable anxiety. Immigration was at record levels. There was movement from the farms to the cities, and families were breaking up. There was a lot of anxiety, particularly among the upper classes and the middle classes. And, you know, many historians would say that eugenics was an attempt by the Native Americans, the upper class Americans, to try to exert some control. They couldn't stop their country from changing entirely, but they could use science as they envisioned it to try to make the nation pure again.
How much science was in there, though? Because, I mean, I grant that there's some understanding of heredity in here, and certainly, you know, we had Darwin's work not terribly long before, but a lot of pseudoscience as well. I mean, when you see terms like germplasm.
Yes, absolutely right. But what is sort of odd to think is that at the time it was considered to be legitimate science. So we're actually getting geneticists from Harvard who are saying, yes, this is valid. So it was pseudoscience at the time was thought to be valid science. They thought that just as you can, you know, we learned through the experiments of Mendel and through other genetic experiments that you could inherit, you know, left-handedness or right-handedness or eye color. These were traits that were inherited. They thought you could inherit traits like being intelligent or being feeble-minded or being indolent or being productive or being, you know, inclined towards poverty or not. So a lot of pseudoscience, but they were inspired by the science to think that they could really do this project.
Well, it sounds like there was certainly an accepted list for the traits that society wanted out of the population, and I wonder how well that list matched up with certain ethnic groups or nationalities.
Absolutely. There was a lot of prejudice in there, and, the racism was stark. And in fact, one of the, you know, many real oddities of the Virginia case was that Virginia passed its sterilization law in 1924 on the same day that it passed a law that increased the penalties for miscegenation, as they called it, for sexual relations between the races. And the thinking was the racist whites in Virginia, they were trying to uplift the white race through genetics. They had actually given up on the black race. They thought it was unworthy. So the two things they wanted to do were to separate the races so that the blacks couldn't, quote, pollute the white race, and then to work on improving the white race by trying to prevent people like Carrie Buck from the lower classes of the white race from reproducing. So there was a lot of bigotry there, and there was absolutely bigotry towards other nationalities. And the Immigration Act of 1924, which really cut off a lot of immigration from Eastern European Jews, Italians, and Asians, a lot of the reason for that was eugenic, that these people were thought by Congress to be less worthy and less fit.
It should be no particular surprise, then, to find that eugenics and the Ku Klux Klan flowered in the same quarter century.
That's exactly right. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, the same idea of saying that, you know, the white race is superior and that, you know, trying to make a, you know, purer America in their viewpoint.
All right. You read a point out that Virginia came a little late to sterilization, and we're trying to get a case that would work before the Supreme Court before they moved ahead with this. So the case did end up before the court, and you say that the case itself, Buck versus Bell, is not much studied. I mean, obviously it's important to what really drove you to this in the first place?
Well, you know, when I was in law school, I didn't learn it, but, you know, it was somehow in the air a little bit. Like, we knew that phrase, three generations of imbeciles are enough, and we knew that Oliver Wendell Holmes had written it. But that was all we knew, and we didn't learn it. So later, when I was thinking about writing a book about the Supreme Court, which I wanted to do, I thought, you know, one of the more interesting ways to study an institution isn't necessarily to look at its greatest success, but to look at, you know, one of its failures and to see what went wrong. And, you know, there have been some famous terrible decisions, you know, Dred Scott, where the Supreme Court said that an enslaved man could not sue for his freedom in federal court, Plessy versus Ferguson, where the court upheld segregated railroad cars, and Korematsu, as you alluded to, the Japanese internment case. But those are pretty well known. Not so much was known about Buck versus Bell. And when I started looking into it, you know, as is so often the case, it just turned out to be such a fascinating story.
Buck versus Bell is the case of Carrie Buck, who was sterilized by the state of Virginia after an 8-1 vote by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's all recounted in Adam Cohen's book, Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange and talk about your thoughts about eugenics and sterilization and any place where these might be appropriate, or your general view of the whole thing. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked just briefly about Carrie herself, labeled feeble-minded and epileptic, and apparently she was neither. But she had some difficult family circumstances that led her an interesting path in life. Tell us about those.
Yeah, you know, so born into poverty in Charlottesville, adopted by this foster family that, you know, treats her terribly and, you know, doesn't let her call the mother and father, and lent out for household work, you know, pulled out of school when she's doing well after fifth grade, and then raped by the nephew of the wife. So she's pregnant out of wedlock, and that's what really sets this whole chain of action into motion. Is when she becomes pregnant, her foster family wants to get rid of her. They don't do the right thing, which is to try to help her with this trauma and this pregnancy. They decide to have her declared epileptic and feeble-minded, which, of course, she was neither, and sent off to this terrible colony. And it was that whole chain of events, her landing at the colony right after Virginia passed its sterilization law, that put her at the center of this case. And it was just, you know, she had a very tragic, you know, youth, and it didn't get much better afterwards.
Well, the whole social welfare system in Virginia at the time seems like it was based on the same set of principles as eugenics itself. I mean, where the smart white people were the ones who should have been raising kids and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And that was actually another movement going on at the time, a progressive idea of, you know, they call them the child savers, of trying to get children out of poverty and get them into, you know, more wholesome circumstances. But breaking up families is always problematic. And here, you know, Carrie Buck had a mother, but they took her mother away and sent her to the colony. And, you know, one thing you often see, not always, of course, but in this case, you know, the people who took Carrie in did not care for her the same way her mother did. In fact, they seemed to be exploiting her, to be putting her to work and not letting her get educated. So it didn't work out very well for Carrie, this idea of putting her in a more middle-class family.
And Carrie sounds like Cinderella without the ball and the fairy godmother.
That's exactly right. She doesn't really get to go to the ball at the end. She doesn't get the prince. She did in later life. She married twice, and you know, parts of her life were not unhappy. She, you know, seemed to, you know, she did have these two marriages that she seemed very devoted to her husband. She always worked, and she carried on a lively correspondence with relatives and even with the colony where her mother was still being kept. So she had a life, you know, a mature life in which there were some pleasures, but you know, she had always wanted to have children. The one child that was born as a result of the rape, you know, sadly died at the age of 8 from a childhood illness, and she always wanted to have more children and couldn't. So yeah, it's not a Cinderella story.
But it sounds like Carrie's pregnancy, the one that she did have, was really the complicating factor that set the wheels in motion. It sounds like the Dobbs family really needed her to disappear.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it was such a stigma back then to be pregnant out of wedlock. And then also there was the added complication that, you know, their nephew had raped her. So that, you know, could have put him in great jeopardy. So to have her there, you know, could, you know, maybe she would at some point tell the police or something, right? So, yes, getting her out of the way seemed like the right thing to do. And, you know, they chose a very cruel thing to do, right, to take a young woman who had been in their care as a foster child, who was not epileptic and not feeble-minded, and ship her off to this horrible institution. But, you know, that was the decision that, you know, clearly worked best for them.
What, if anything, did Carrie have at her disposal? I mean, this is years before we started giving people lawyers for even criminal trials. So, I mean, did she have anything really to fight the move to put her on the colony, as it was known?
Yeah, well, not to be sent to the colony. She had no. She went to a hearing where she wasn't represented, and then when the decision was made at the colony to sterilize her, the law required that she be given a guardian. But it doesn't seem like the guardian did very much to prevent it. And then when it worked its way through the court system, the Virginia law required that she be given a lawyer. But yet another, you know, very sad part of this case is that the lawyer who was appointed to represent her in the Virginia courts and then all the way to the Supreme Court was actually a friend of all the people who ran the colony. He had been the chairman of the board of the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded, and he wrote terrible briefs, and he did very little to try to protect her interests at trial, put on, you know, no expert witnesses of any kind. So she got a really terrible representation from a lawyer who did not seem to be on her side, and no one seemed to be on her side. Her mother was, you know, imprisoned at the colony, so couldn't look out for her. Her father had died, and it was a day when there weren't, you know, public interest groups looking out for the developmentally disabled or incarcerated people or, you know, institutionalized people. So she really had no advocates. You know, this poor young woman, undereducated because they pulled her out of school, rape victim, and no one looking out for her.
You talked about the fact that they made the decision about where to put Carrie and her mother Emma on the scale, morons at the top, imbeciles in the middle, idiots at the bottom, based on an IQ test. The test itself apparently has undergone quite a bit of scrutiny and, in fact, was not even really used correctly, was it?
You know, the tests back then were so primitive, and they had been originated in France really in order to diagnose students who could use some extra help, but the inventor said they did not want to use it as an intelligence test because it wasn't. It kind of got refashioned in the United States and was used to label people in these very categorical ways. But when you look at the questions, some of the questions that Carrie was asked, you know, remain in her files from the colony, and the questions are literally things like, what do you do when a playmate hits you? Well, you know, what is the intelligent answer to that? Who knows? And there are other questions like that. So we're not talking, you know, highly, you know, scientifically developed, you know, current SAT or ACT tests, and even those, of course, some question, but we're talking extremely subjective tests, and there's some, you know, man in a white coat who's saying, you know, I don't like your answer to what do you do when a playmate hits you. I'm going to decide that you are, you know, feeble-minded.
Wow. Here's a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Adam Cohen, the author of Imbeciles.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Good morning, guest. Well, a random thought and a personal anecdote. The random thought is like, I didn't ask to be born to a world I never made, and that seems to be the bitter thing about this is that these people had no control over their individual lives, therefore they were perfectly set up to be victims.
Mm-hmm.
Now the personal anecdote is like, in my puberty years, I was given an intelligence test, And it was later determined that I was just one point shy of being rated as gifted. And when we got the results of the test, my mother asked me the question that I had missed, and I gave it to her as a good answer. And therefore, I could have technically been gifted, and I'd be working for a think tank and having my brain picked for the rest of my life. But just the author, I would like to say, ask, why do you think that people use such arbitrary things to do such horrible things to each other? And Jeffrey, I'll take his answer off the phone.
All right, thanks, Jamie. Appreciate that. Adam?
Boy, that is a great question. Really cuts to the heart of this. A lot of this is about, you know, creating these hierarchies, inflexible hierarchies, people feeling that they're at the top of the hierarchies, looking down at the people at the bottom of the hierarchies. So we see that with these intelligence categories, which, as the caller rightly said, you know, these inflexible, you know, you're an idiot, you're an imbecile, you're a moron, and those are the categories. But you also saw it even in the Supreme Court, right? The great sin of this decision is that the great Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was born in a very fancy, you know, Boston family, Boston Brahmin, looked down on people like Harry Buck, you know, thought that he was at the top of the pecking order, she was at the bottom, and therefore had no problem saying she should be sterilized because she was in this, you know, lesser group. So I think, you know, the caller really put his finger on it, that I think this kind of thinking of, you know, the categories and we're at the top and you're at the bottom leads to a lot of very bad results.
Now, that same test, the Binet-Simon test that was given to Carrie and Emma and everybody else in the colony, I presume, was also given to large groups of immigrants, wasn't it?
It was, and you know, these tests showed just how terrible the testing was. There was one administration that got a lot of publicity where they said between 40% and 50% of the Eastern European Jews arriving at Ellis Island were feeble-minded. Well, that just can't be true, but they should have used that to discredit the test, but instead they used it to discredit the immigrants.
Wow, a lot that pressed on in the age of eugenics, which is what we're talking about here with Adam Cohen. His book is Imbeciles. We'll talk more with him and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return for the final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Adam Cohen, Harvard Law graduate and journalist. He researched the age of eugenics in America, where we thought we could breed a stronger race by breeding out, as in sterilizing, people who had lesser intellects and traits like that. His book is called Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Give your thoughts on eugenics generally, places where you might think there is an appropriate use for forced sterilization. Our phone number here, 800-838-3760. Email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So you pointed out earlier that that Carrie Buck in Virginia in the 1920s was considered an imbecile and also epileptic. What was the view of epilepsy at that time?
Very uninformed view. You know, from ancient times, there was often a lot of stigma associated with epilepsy, and you know, there were even, you know, beliefs that it was associated with, you know, with the devil and things like that. So there was a lot of fear of epileptics, and they didn't know what to do with them, and there was a lot of sentiment for just finding a place to lock them up, and that's what happened in Virginia. They actually first created a colony for epileptics, and then they added the feeble-minded to it. But there was just a thought that these were people we needed to get away from us because they might be dangerous.
So I have to believe that, since you mentioned Virginia came late to this, 1927 was years after some of the forced sterilizations. Was there a public outcry beginning to build by the time the Carrie Buck case began to work its way up through the courts?
You know, it's amazing how late, you know, the opposition to it came. And, you know, there was just a lot of, you know, just a lot of thought leaders were really caught up in an epileptic, in a eugenic worldview, right? So it was hard to kind of break away from that. And then when the Supreme Court gave their imprimatur to eugenic sterilization, that really, you know, just added fuel to the fire. We had a shortage of people who were really seeing things correctly and speaking out, I would say.
We have another call here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Cohen, the author of Imbeciles.
Good morning, Adam, and good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
I happen to have been researching that subject not long ago, and with my background and mainly and researched all American funding for mainly, truly, really. Anyway, but what I'm two things I wanted to raise. One is two additional words in your title. Instead of saying the Supreme Court, you might say the all male Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that leads to the second suggestion question. It's a subject of human, and in most cases, male human defined humanity that makes this case something of history that is worthless if we don't learn from it. Okay, and where I'm going with this is that today, if you give scientists, if you give politicians the power to define this, they may start with some kind of kernel of sane consideration, but then it turns into power. It turns into, I define what's good. I will not examine my own motivations, you know.
Mm.
And what then comes out, and that's a today issue, okay? The today issue is, what is proper sexual identification? Is it good or bad to be, quote, gender dysphoric?
Mm-hmm.
That, like, every child must be clearly pink or pale blue, and if they aren't, we're going to consider them by law, please, okay? That's where the lawmakers, with the best intentions, maybe some of them.
Okay, let's get a response from Adam. I appreciate the thoughts, Wolfgang.
A couple of thoughts. One is that I think that is some of this categorization that we were talking about before, the desire to put people in sharp categories, which could be, you know, gender-related, or they could be imbecile, moron, and idiot. But on the gender point, you know, I take the caller's point, and, I set up the book so it is four men who are all trying to sterilize Carrie Buck. But, you know, one thing, if we look at the history honestly, is that women were actually very, very involved in the eugenics movement and were some of the leaders of it. And when legislation came up in state legislatures, it was often women's groups and, you know, even the League of Women Voters who were very pro-eugenics, and women who were actually kept out of a lot of policy discussions in the 1920s, very sexist time, were sometimes invited into eugenic discussions because it was thought to be about reproduction and the family. And it would be great to say that there were women, you know, and if there had been women on the Supreme Court, they might have voted differently. But actually, women were among the strongest supporters of eugenics.
Wow. Another call here from Tony and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Cohen, the author of Imbeciles.
Yeah, carrying on with the same theme of the Supreme Court, one can imagine that if there had been someone of the like of Antonin Scalia, or all the other there's a predominantly Catholic sitting members of the court right now, with their beliefs in the sanctity of life, would presumably not have been as sort of fascistic, shall we say, as Wendell Holmes. I mean, progressives of the era, as you said, believed in this stuff. It was, what might say, the settled science of that time. And I know that race, everything has to be seen through the prism of race in this country, but the fact is, I think, that you'll find that, and I know you're concentrating on in America, but Sweden has possibly the worst record of all. They got, according to various reports, they got rid of forcibly sterilized 60,000 people over the course of, I don't know, about 40 years. This was in a country with 6 million. And it didn't cease until 1975.
Wow, long time that went on. Thank you for that, Tony. Appreciate it. And in fact, Adam, you point out that part of the eugenic movement in Europe, or at least in Nazi Germany, seemed to gain some momentum from studying what was going on in America.
Absolutely. They were looking to our statutes and modeling themselves on it very much. I should say about the caller's earlier point, though, it is true. Catholics were, you know, some of the heroes of this story. And when legislation was introduced around the country for eugenic sterilization, the group that was most likely to show up and oppose it were Catholics. You'd have priests and nuns and archbishops showing up at the legislature and arguing against eugenic sterilization laws. And there were some states like Louisiana where laws were voted down where it was because of the Catholic Church. So we do need to, you know, credit them for getting this one right. And it was partly because of the Catholic views about reproduction and opposition to abortion and so forth. But it was also the Catholic view that Catholics, you know, tended to view people based on their spiritual qualities, not on these, you know, physical qualities that the eugenicists were focused on. So I think the caller may be right that, you know, if there had been more Catholics on the court, the one Catholic who was on the court did dissent from the ruling.
What do you find in the way, I don't know if you followed the thread more into current days, and whether there's still some sense that there are some cases where sterilization is justified, or does this flop over into abortion issues and discussion of perhaps aborting fetuses when they're deemed to be deficient in one way or the other? I mean, this is still an argument we're having, isn't it? Just not calling it eugenics?
Absolutely, and you know, there's so many interesting, fascinating strands mixed into this. But you know, there's the question of right: do we do prenatal testing and find qualities that we might lead us to want to abort a fetus? Perhaps, and a lot of people do that. But you know, that's the choice usually of the parents, which is different from the state imposing a rule. But then we have, you know, other questions about, you know, what should the state be able to do? And these are going to become even more complicated with the changing technology. In China recently, they did the first editing of a human embryo, which allows, you know, editing of particular genes in an embryo. This will make eugenic type decisions much easier, much cheaper. And, you know, what do we do with that? Do we allow parents to edit their genes of their embryos? And these are changes that will occur not only in their own children, but in future generations. So they're really changing humanity. Do we allow parents to do that? Do we ever allow the state to require that, or should the state prohibit it? These are really tough ethical issues that we have not begun to work out.
Okay, so back to the Carrie Buck time, though, when we had a belief in eugenics and people at all levels of society interested in this. There was even a eugenics records office. What was that about?
Yeah, so this was an office on Long Island that that was the center of eugenic research and advocacy. So it trained people in eugenics methods so they could go out and do eugenics field work. And then also Harry Laughlin, one of the villains of my book who ran the Eugenics Record Office, he wrote the model statute that, you know, states relied on to draw up their own statutes. He was an expert witness in the Buck case. He testified through an affidavit that Carrie Buck was feeble-minded and that she should be sterilized. So this became the big center of eugenic thought for many years and eugenic activity, and it really lasted until the last days of 1939 when it lost its funding because of the rise of Nazis, and the foundation that funded it began to feel this was not, you know, acceptable work anymore.
Which you know, is something that Tony said in his call. He used the term settled science, and I can certainly imagine that there are some people who would oppose some of the things we talk about in our time, like climate change, for example, because that's settled science. But, I mean, was it ever really held up in high esteem? Were there dissenting members of the scientific community talking about eugenics?
You know, it was shocking at the beginning how much unanimity there was. So there was one study that found that between 1899 and 1912, every article that appeared in a medical journal about eugenic sterilization was in favor of it. But towards the mid-20s, we began to get, you know, more people speaking out, and we began to get some geneticists questioning the science. So eventually, you know, support begins to devolve a bit. But at the beginning, it was shocking how few scientists and experts said there was anything wrong with this.
You talked about Harry Laughlin providing an affidavit in Carrie Buck's court case. Through the courts, I mean, how much were the claims about Carrie ever challenged? Did anybody ever get up and say, no, it's not true? You know, she's been educated. You know, she went to school through, what, the sixth grade, I guess, and so can write her name and all that stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great question. The problem was that her lawyer wasn't really on her side. Her lawyer was really on the colony side. So the moment that really should have occurred, the moment, was the first trial when she's ordered sterilized and they go to court in trial court in Virginia, and there's a trial about whether she should be sterilized. That's where they introduce Laughlin's affidavit. Her lawyer should have had experts on the other side saying, these tests are all bogus. If you look at Carrie Buck's full life, you'd see, here are her grades in school. Her grades were good. You'd see that she got pulled out of school. Here are some people who know her who can testify she's not feeble-minded. None of that was done. So that was the place where the record would have been created that, you know, could have made it up to the Supreme Court, and they could have seen that she was an intelligent young woman, that, you know, she wasn't feeble-minded, and here are her school records. But her lawyer never did that, so that never happened.
Now I'm really curious about the oral arguments at the Supreme Court. I know you probably looked at these records. How robust was that argument?
You know, actually, that's one of the real oddities of doing history at this point. Unbelievably, those records don't exist. They weren't
really?
Keeping transcripts. Yeah. So what we have to rely on is the briefs. But we can tell from the briefs that the lawyer who was trying to get her sterilized, a guy named Aubrey Strobe, wrote, you know, really excellent and detailed briefs that made the case very well. Her lawyer, on the other hand, wrote short briefs, much shorter than the other side, and they did not cite the important precedents in many cases. And in some cases, they included arguments that really seemed to cut in favor of sterilization, like pointing out that in ancient times there were many people who were sterilized, and, you know, and in Plato's time. And so you read these briefs thinking, like, boy, how much more could he have tried to, you know, make this a brief that is not going to persuade the court?
And what was the eventual number? I mean, by the time we were done sterilizing people by the state, how many people had the procedure done?
Well, you know, the thought is that it's as many as 70,000 people in America were sterilized for eugenic reasons, and many more were locked away for many years, all their reproductive years, in order to stop them from reproducing. And then when you add in all the people who couldn't immigrate to this country because the laws were changed, because they were thought to be, you know, eugenically less gifted, there were so many different victims of this movement, this terrible movement.
Did Carrie's mom, Emma, ever leave the colony?
She did not. So, you know, Carrie is let go after she's sterilized and no longer deemed to be a threat, and she, you know, works in various jobs and marries twice in life. Emma is never let go, and Carrie used to write to her and to send her food and wanted to get the colony to let her come and visit her. And, you know, it's in this correspondence between Carrie and the colony that you see most vividly, because these letters survive, how intelligent she was. These are letters of an intelligent, caring woman who cares about her mother, who can write very coherent sentences, beautiful handwriting. It was her speaking from the past saying, I wasn't feeble-minded.
Wow. Sterilized by the state. That was the condition of Carrie Buck. She is one of the main characters in Adam Cohen's book about that period of American history. Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.